It's Coast to Coast AM, and this is Ian Punnett giving George Norrie a well-deserved night off. In fact, not just this week, but also next Friday night, too. I think it stuck with me two Fridays in a row, and I'm coming to you from the New York studios of Premier Radio Networks, where I am in the Ryan Seacrest studios. Let me tell you, I've used these studios before, these same wonderful studios. The first time I used them, they were still Glenn Beck's studios. Then the next time I used them, they were Stephen A. Smith's studios. And now it's Ryan Seacrest. And Ryan's got the nicest stuff. So of all the three big-name people to use this studio, it's undergone an upgrade under Ryan Seacrest, I can tell you that. And I don't think he uses it that much, but it's a nice place, so thank you. Because I was here this particular weekend for the rollout, the press rollout for Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I posted some thoughts on that on my Facebook page, or at least I was trying to anyway. I think they ended up on there. I'll have to talk to my web guy, Scratchy. But the point of that was is that it's super good. And if my review hasn't made it up yet, it will soon. It doesn't come out until next weekend. But this is the same movie that I had visited in production in Vancouver last year and was just captivated by the sets and this what they call performance capture CGI, where the actors can see themselves performing as their computer-generated characters in real time. And this was crucial for all of these ape actors. But it was it really enjoyable. Book it for next weekend, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's the origin story. How did it come about, the story of the Planet of the Apes? If you know the classic Charlton Heston movie, this is a worthy prequel. I promise you that. And you're going to love this show tonight. We'll get to open lines, as the tradition is on Friday nights on Coast to Coast, coming up a little bit later on. But I got to tell you about this new book called Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. What artwork is missing and where is it? You know, are these all wealthy billionaires with these basements filled with stolen art, or is there another story that you've yet to hear about? And what about drug lords and art? What about organized crime and art? I mean, is there such a thing as that classic Pierce Brosnan / Sean Connery / Steve McQueen like image of the art thief who gets a shopping list from some millionaire who says, bring me these paintings, while they stroke a white pussycat like Dr. No. And we'll tell you about that. Just who is it that's behind these heists and more when we talk with the co-authors of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists, coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. I will be hosting my usual night. And I'm looking forward to a conversation with Howard Bloom about the economy. You've heard that the debt ceiling is not yet raised. There has been a lot of back and forth about that today. Votes in Congress, votes in the Senate, still no resolution yet, and a possibility that we will not be able to avoid some sort of collision with the debt ceiling. We'll be ramming our heads into the debt ceiling coming up next week. Well, what will that mean for the economy? We've asked Howard Bloom to imagine our future next week. He's the smartest man in America, and he's working on that right now. We'll talk to him tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. Worth catching. Also, I actually am going to see Howard Bloom tomorrow, sometime in Brooklyn. While I'm here, I just thought, okay, well, Muhammad will have to come to the mountain, but I'm going to see Howard Bloom tomorrow before we do the show tomorrow night. And I don't often get a chance to do that, meet face-to-face with our guests here on Coast to Coast. But I'm looking forward to telling you more about the real world of art thievery. Who's really behind it? Before we get to open lines coming up next. In for George Norrie tonight, this is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. All right, so tonight on Coast to Coast, we'll get to open lines later, but I want to bring in two co-authors here of the book Stealing Rembrandts. I'll start by introducing Tom Mashberg, who's an award-winning investigative reporter and the Sunday editor for the Boston Herald, along with a lot of other great publications he's written for over the years. Good evening, Tom.
Hi, how are you? Good to be here.
Good, nice to have you. And then Anthony Amore, or do you say Amore, Anthony?
Amore.
Okay, who is also a columnist with the Boston Herald, but it works security, head of security at Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum since 2005, as well as, and I just want to ask you about this before we get started, you played a role in the apprehension or the stopping of the so-called shoe bomber back in 2001. So before we find out more about the art heist in light of one would-be terrorist who was stopped earlier this week, allegedly, tell me about you and the shoe bomber back in 2001, Anthony.
Well, Ian, it's really an interesting story, one I'll never forget. I remember it was a Sunday afternoon here in Boston getting ready to watch a football game and received a call from my boss asking me to head into the airport because a nuisance passenger was trying to light a shoelace on fire on his sneaker. And by the time I got from my home to the airport, which is only about 7 minutes at the time, I walked into a teleconference with NORAD and air traffic control about a possible terrorist attack. And suffice it to say, 36 hours later, still working on a case now about the terrorist who is in the operational phase of a plan who tried to, ignite explosives on an aircraft.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
Not for the heroic actions of the crew and some passengers, he very well might have been successful.
Well, first of all, I have my doubts about that story only because I know nothing is 7 minutes from Logan. So you can't possibly – you can't even get to Logan in 7 minutes from Logan. So – but let me ask you about this. So I've always said this, that the more information people have, the more likely they're going to be able to stop a terrorist attack. And we know that this it would seem – I mean, again, going by the published reports – that the owner of this gun store was suspicious about this particular serviceman who's in question in a would-be terrorist attack at Fort Hood. And it was regular plain old passengers and crew that stopped that attack from happening. I think the more the American flying, the American observing public knows, the better we can be in keeping these attacks from ever happening.
You know, that's really an excellent point, and that's, I think, what you're going to see in the future of Homeland Security, where public engagement is really the key to protecting the United States or being involved in helping recover from some type of attack or natural disaster. I was watching a speech by a friend of mine the other night, Steve Flynn, who spoke to the National Governors Association. He made the point that on 9/11, about 500,000 people on Manhattan headed south, and they were sort of trapped on the island because of the attacks. And a flotilla, basically, of volunteers using their own sea craft, removed this 500,000 people from the island, also ultimately evacuated them. Just regular citizens or other boats. It wasn't military or government. And when you think about that type of, you can't top that type of activism. So I totally agree with what you said.
Well, and I promise you, Tom, I'll get back to the new book too and bring you back into the conversation, but I will just say this. Flying again today reminds me of how secretive so much of our security is, and unnecessarily so. I mean, I asked several times, well, why are we doing this? You don't need to know that, sir. You don't need to know that. And I think, well, you know what? You missed the opportunity to kind of deputize all of us people if we know what to look for. And so just this thought that somehow there's all this, important secret information out there, it ends up feeling like it's just information that's intended to manipulate the public instead of inform us, let us make the decision of what's happening. And who knows, we might be able to stop another shoe bomber or another underwear bomber or whatever the next plan is. So I'll just leave that again out there for now and just reintroduce Tom Mashberg, who is the co-author of Stealing Rembrandt's. It's a great book. I'm kind of a big fan of the heist caper, right? A good, you know, I love like the Ocean's 11 series, and I love to watch a movie where people attempt to get away with something really complex, something that requires a ton of planning and that sort of, you know, synchronized scheduling in order to be able to pull off something like the impossible, the stealing of a Rembrandt. But that's not really the real story behind the stealing Rembrandt's. It's actually very low tech, and frequently it's just kind of a matter of some people just kind of stumble into a chance to steal something as famous as Rembrandt's. I know you do a lot of myth busting in this book. So, Tom Mashburg, I'll ask you to address up front, why Rembrandt? Why is Rembrandt such a popular subject for people to try to steal?
Well, there's two main reasons. One is that his name is so famous. I mean, he probably is the greatest artist in human history, and his paintings are superb. And, of course, you know, it's like a nickname you give somebody who draws well. Hey, look at the Rembrandt.
Right.
And so, you know, just the fame attached to his name. I mean, there's this Rembrandt toothpaste, et cetera. You know, basically every common criminal and low-rent hood out there can recognize the name Rembrandt as meaning, oh, that's a guy who painted valuable stuff. So that's one reason. Then another crucial reason is that he left a large body of work behind, more than 200 oil paintings and maybe some 600-odd drawings and a lot of etchings. And so his work is just scattered around the United States and around Europe and even around the globe. And so, you know, when you have so many locations that have these paintings, you're bound to have some that just don't have the kind of, you know, attention to security that's necessary to keep them safe.
Well, and yet, let's just stipulate up front, Rembrandt is not the most stolen artist. That title would go to Picasso.
Yeah, Picasso, of course, probably did, 100 times more works than Rembrandt. So it's a hard comparison to make. Yes, many, many more Picassos have been stolen, but he made so many little sort of goofy drawings on napkins and things. Whereas when somebody steals a Rembrandt, and there have been 81 Rembrandt thefts in the past century, they're stealing, you know, something that's fairly rare and you know, extremely valuable. It's everything is top-notch stuff.
Yeah, everything's top-notch except the security for a lot of these art museums. And again, that's the specialty of Anthony Amore, the co-author of Stealing Rembrandt's. Because what I think when we have the image of the art theft, it's of, you know, somebody lowering themselves from the ceiling of a building on specially made, some specially made apparatus, and then suction cups on their knees and hands to get in through the windows and all of that. And that really isn't the story of most art heists, is it?
No, oftentimes you see that the art is stolen by someone who does a smash and grab type theft or rushes the museum with weapons. Or you even see instances where people just walk into the museum in broad daylight and remove an item from the wall and walk out with it. So there's a real wide array. And as you point out, it's more often the types of theft that I just described than the very rare instances where you see this Mission Impossible type going into a gallery and climbing acrobatically over these red laser beams that you don't see in real life.
Right. Yeah. Which, by the way, everybody should have. I mean, I think they're, if nothing else, they're cool looking. So everybody should have red lasers just to have red lasers. But
they're cool looking, but you have to remember that if those existed in real life, why would you, if you, from a security point of view, why would you show the red lasers to show the thieves what they should walk over when?
No, you don't show them. That's why you have, you know, like Catherine Zeta-Jones blowing makeup from her compact into the atmosphere that reveals the red lasers. See?
Yeah, if only that's how it happened.
Right. But again, we're talking about some of the great art heists of all time, and we'll get into some of the untold stories of these art heists, because there are some fascinating stories. But we do have a lot of Hollywood imagery in our mind when it comes to these particular paintings and the fact that they've been stolen so often. Like, a lot of Rembrandts have been stolen multiple times, right? I mean, they find it, they put it back up on the wall, and then somebody steals it again.
Yeah, there have been definitely a couple of multiple thefts. There's a famous case of a portrait in London that was by Rembrandt that's been stolen four times and is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most filched painting. So, you can have very bizarre scenarios like that. And, you know, I was thinking about what you're saying about, robbing a museum with all that gadgetry. And it occurs to me that about the only people who could put together the equipment necessary to rob a museum are, a group of Hollywood special effects people.
Right.
I mean, they'd be good at it.
Right. Well, the average,
schmuck doesn't have, a lot of repelling wires and, smoke-making machines and, crampons that, magnetic, crampons to walk along the sides of walls. That stuff's tough to get, and it's expensive.
Yeah, or those special alloys that don't exist out in the real world that they have some guy make in Luxembourg or something. There's always these. But let's get back to that, though, because these art heists, I mean, they do go on, and obviously people are successful at stealing artwork, and a lot of it's because the museums have such poor security to begin with. So at some point I will ask you for, at least the short list of the characteristics of the successful art thief. So not that I'm thinking about going into art thievery anytime soon, but it's always nice, to have something to fall back on. And so I'd like to know, what is it that the successful art thieves have in common? But let me just let me ask you about who it is, though, that does finance these thefts. I mean, we have that image, that Dr. No image, of somebody who has a list and an envelope full of cash, and they call in somebody who's a specialist in this, and they say, I want this painting, and that painting, and they hand that list over, and the guy has to go out and try to find a way to crack into all these different museums to get those paintings. But that there really aren't any, those people just don't exist.
Well, I'll let Anthony answer this, because I know he's called the Sultan of Brunei directly, just to make sure he doesn't have any stolen paintings in his private office.
Anthony?
Well, you never know, right? But, it's an interesting thing, and that's one of the first things you learn from reading Stephen Rembrandt. You see that there are very few instances of individuals financing a theft. First, it's not really necessary. An art theft at a museum, as we prove in the book, is not something very expensive.
No.
And that's it, not to jump the gun on the description of an art thief, but it's more moxie than it is money. You don't really need to have a whole bunch of equipment to do it, that sort of thing. It's very, very rare to find someone is even behind an art theft, that someone commissioned it. The idea of a shopping list, I often say, is probably one more senior hood telling one of his underlings on a piece of paper, steal a Rembrandt, and Rembrandt's probably spelled incorrectly. These are not really sophisticated criminal organizations.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a case in Cincinnati we write about where these thieves broke in to steal these two extremely valuable Rembrandts that were on display there, and instead they stole two far lesser Rembrandts, one of which turned out not even to be a Rembrandt.
Well, hang on to that story. I want to get back to that. I want to ask you about organized crime and art thievery. I want to ask you about drug lords and art thievery. Let's take a look at World War II, but also I want to know, where are these stolen Rembrandts? What does history tell us? What do your instincts tell us? As who has them? Are they sitting somewhere rolled up in a tube under somebody's bed, or in those great shoe boxes of history that's, right now just giving somebody some smug sense of satisfaction that they have a Rembrandt in their closet? Or are there secret underground lairs full of stolen artwork? We'll get back to Stealing Rembrandts. Anthony Amore and Tom Mashberg, co-authors of these untold stories of art thievery, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Get it? There we go. The Rembrandts. And the theme from Friends. I was reminded of that song earlier this week. I was talking with Lisa Kudrow. She's got a new TV series. It's very funny. It's called Web Therapy. She is not coming up tonight, but we'll talk more about Rembrandts, that is to say, the untold stories of notorious art heists, coming up in just a moment. Before we get to open lines later on this evening on Coast to Coast, and I also want to give a shout out to two people, Dennis Falcone, who's here from Premier Radio Networks to run the show from the Premier Studios in New York. And he's always handy to be here, and it's nice to have an experienced hand at the tiller. But I also want to say hi to Dr. Rick Wright, who's a professor at Syracuse University's S.I. Newhouse School of Communications, as well as a radio personality in his own right. Dr. Rick Wright is old school, high energy personality radio host of a program that runs on one of our Clear Channel family members in Syracuse, Power 620, the voice of the community. And I'll just say, the guy is absolutely amazing. And he had me on as a guest last Sunday on his birthday show. And I was honored to be there. It's a fun show, and I just love that old funk that he plays so well. And you're going to like what you're hearing coming up just a second. Where are these paintings? Where is all the stolen artwork housed? And who has been able to get away with it? What pieces are we still missing? And what are the characteristics of a successful art thief? You might be surprised at that answer, especially coming up next on Coast to Coast. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. Coming up tomorrow night in the first hour on Coast to Coast, we'll be talking more about the movie Planet of the Apes, the rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's the reboot. It's the origin story of Planet of the Apes, and we'll get to that in the first hour. Way cool. And then we'll look deeply into Howard Bloom's crystal ball about what might be happening to our economy. May be happening, but Howard Bloom is one smart guy, and he knows the nature of this beast, and we'll talk about that coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, if we don't meet that debt ceiling thing next week. So Tom Mashberg and Anthony Amore, co-authors of Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Let's just start with, how many of these Rembrandts are still floating out there somewhere, guys?
That's a difficult thing to say, and with any type of confidence, because oftentimes art is stolen and it's underreported. People who have maybe a Rembrandt, especially a sketch or an etching in their home collection, oftentimes people don't want to report that type of loss because they don't want the public to know about high-value items that are in their home. Same is true of galleries. Typically, when a museum loses a Rembrandt, you'll hear about that in the news. It's usually a larger size portrait or what have you. The most significant one, though, that we know that hasn't been recovered with a painting stolen in the 70s from Montreal. And if not for the Gardner Museum heist, it would be the largest art theft in history. That was one Rembrandt. And of course, at the museum at which I work, Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, the largest property theft of all time occurred in 1990. And we lost three Rembrandts in that theft. One of them, the second most valuable stolen piece.
Right. But that was before your watch, right?
Oh yeah, that was before Anthony took over in security in 2000.
I just want to give credit where credit is due. Wasn't it? But back then, and this so often is the case, and either you, Tom, or Anthony can answer this. A lot of these museums, they can't even afford the insurance on the actual paintings, so if they can't afford the insurance on the paintings, they're sure as heck not going to be able to pay a ransom for these paintings once they're stolen.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is very costly to insure, you know, ultra-expensive works of art. And there are also cases where the Rembrandts are in, you know, the ancestral homes of, say, British earls and lords. And several of those have been broken into over the years. And in one case, at a castle in a place called Chilham in England, a very nice Rembrandt that he painted a portrait of his wife. It was stolen among many other paintings. If you look in the book, there's an excellent photograph of this poor Sir Edmund Davis looking at the wreckage of his painting room with all these crashed down frames and sort of broken you know, bits and pieces. And anyway, what the sad truth is, as we report for the first time in the book, the sad story here is that that painting was burned by the thieves and destroyed because they were afraid it would be, you know, create a trail that
would lead back to them. It's like shooting the kidnapped victim somehow instead of returning them.
Art napping in the book, because that's really what you've done when you've stolen a major painting by Rembrandt. You've basically performed a kidnapping, and now you have this this item that you cannot. The outside world does not want to buy. There's no secondary market. There's really no way to sort of convert it into cash. And the only choice you have is to try to sell it back to its owner for a ransom or some sort of insurance money or reward. Now, in the case of the gardener, they've put together a $5 million reward thanks to the generosity of many of their donors and whatnot. But in many cases, that, like the museum that Anthony mentioned in Canada, there is just not the kind of money around for that level of reward.
And we could even say, maybe even if we can use this term, in the golden age of Rembrandt stealing, when this was going on a lot, the image of a technically unsophisticated museum guarded by some retired former deputy with a rusty gun was probably actually closer to the truth than we like to think of with the red lasers and all of the high-tech security.
I mean, museums, their priorities are acquiring and curating. And then, of course, you know, they want to put the art on display, and, you know, they want it to be as accessible as possible, which is, of course, understandable. I mean, you know, in a bank, the money's in a vault. In a jewelry store, it's in a big safe or behind plexiglass. But when you go in a museum, you want to see that art up close. You know, you want to put your nose an inch away from a Rembrandt. That's the big treat. And so you have this kind of very close call between, you know, accessibility and vulnerability. And the museums of, you know, they tend to be a little on the stodgy side, and they, you know, they like to hire these kind of, you know, old gentlemen, you know, with white hair.
Right. They kind of almost a docent more than somebody who's a security expert.
That's right. I mean, nobody who could, you know, really successfully chase down a quick-footed criminal or obviously if somebody, as often happens, barges in with firearms or automatic weapons.
Right.
Then it's all over.
And takes the artwork.
Just jump in really quickly.
Go ahead, Anthony.
The darts that we have employed at the Gardner Museum don't fit that stereotype. But the other point I would like to make is that the technology at museums is actually quite good, the security technology.
But that's now. It just hasn't always been that way, right?
You know, if you go back to even 1990, you see that what was out there and available to an institution like a museum was basically the state-of-the-art stuff. It's just that there's no way to ensure 100% security for any facility. And when you talk about museums, as Tom rightly said, accessibility is the goal for the public.
Well,
adding to that, the museum buildings aren't designed for security. They're designed for aesthetics, so it makes it more difficult.
Well, I'm just the point is, it doesn't take a Danny Ocean to put together a plan to steal some of these Rembrandts, as we learn in the book, Stealing Rembrandts. Let me ask you, where are they then? Whether it's Rembrandts or any other of these still missing classic works of art that we know were stolen and were may never have ever been resold that we know of, where are they?
It's shocking where they're usually found. They're very easy to hide, and oftentimes they're stored under a bed in a home. Oftentimes drug dealers or drug runners are involved in art theft, and they have these hides built into the walls of their home, and the art's hidden there. We even tell the story in the book about a Rembrandt that was stolen in Worcester, Massachusetts, from the Worcester Art Museum, that wound up being hidden in a barn in a hayloft at a pig farm in Rhode Island. It's never some type of underground lair, as you before the break.
That we know of, right? I mean, you're talking about the ones we find. I guess theoretically it's possible that somewhere somebody's got some kind of secret elevator off of their smoking room in their house, and they can go down to their gallery of stolen artwork. It's just no one's found that yet. All the ones we find are the people that have it, you know, they're using it as a placemat. You know, those are the ones we find later on.
Well, it's funny because, you know, that's one of those, we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
If you look back at history, every single time art is found or ultimately turned in, whether it's gone for a day or for 20 or 30 years, it always winds up being a case that it's much less fantastic than the movies.
Right. Let me ask you about this then. These pieces, you mentioned the drug lords. If there is a consistency in the organization of these art thefts, would you say that there are more drug lords involved, organized crime families involved, just plain old crimes of opportunity thieves? I mean, what categories do they fall into?
It's a little bit of each of that, but I would say, rather than organized crime, you find it's disorganized crime. It's like a low-level associates of crime families, the kind of guys who run the errands for larger organized crime figures. They don't do this on behalf of the lords or the godfathers. They do it because they're just career criminals. When you talk about, it's not drug lords, but, you know, your common coke dealer and his associates who are looking for a quick score. So the one thing they all have in common is that they lack foresight. They all see a great opportunity to steal something of great value. They have absolutely no idea how to fence it because it's almost impossible to do so.
Are there no, you know, fences like we expect them in the Hollywood movie, Tom, where there's somebody somewhere who works exclusively in the black market art,
world? We just haven't found any person like that or any evidence of any person like that. And yeah, it's a little, we feel a little, like we're kind of deflating people's, idea of art theft. Maybe this myth continues because, people think that art collectors are kind of shady characters to begin with. So it's likely that they would steal them, but it's just a sort of, the truth of the matter is that time and time again, you're looking at smash and grabs, at home invasion type robberies, and you're looking at guys who can't find a fence, can't find anybody to give it to. In many cases, they'll drop the art off frustrated. They'll leave it in a public place like a train station and just call the police and say, you know, go pick it up because it can't be bothered anymore. So it's just not something that you see or trace with any regularity. By now you would have found some evidence of it. I mean, in this, you know, multimedia universe, you know, it's just so hard to keep things like that secret anyway.
So if you had to list some characteristics of the successful art thief, the kind of person who would get away with stealing a Rembrandt, what would be those characteristics?
I would think it would be someone who has, again, a lot of moxie, the guts to walk into a facility, oftentimes broad daylight, and just walk up to a great piece of art and just lift it off the wall and believe they're going to get away with it. It's also someone who has very little regard for culture or you know, his fellow man who might want to, who has the desire to see art. A lot of times it's people who have some type of grudge against what they see as blue blood, and, you know, art museums are the playground for the rich, when in fact they're actually set up so that all members of society can enjoy this, you know, the best that man can produce.
But there has been those classist arguments where it's I'm where somebody fancies themselves as kind of an artful Robin Hood.
Exactly.
Yeah, plenty, I mean, there is a character in our book that comes close, the closest to fitting that bill. He's actually a guy from Massachusetts who's robbed a bunch of museums in this area, and he's robbed two Rembrandts in his distinguished career. His name is Miles Connor, and I've interviewed him at length many times and, you know, seen, he's a very erudite guy. He knows a lot about art and antiques, and, you know, he stole a lot of stuff, in fact, to collect. So he's kind of in that rare category, but he stole it himself and then kept it for himself. And he, you know, the heist that he pulled off at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which is a giant, beautiful museum right in the middle of the city, is a kind of a classic crime where he had some people dressed like civilians wandering around inside to sort of screen him. And then he put on a little outfit looking like sort of a kind of a debonair guy. And he grabbed this painting right off the wall, put it under his arm and ran out with it. And then outside he had a truck waiting, a van, I should say, with a couple of bad guys with automatic weapons in the back. And they actually laid down a precision line of machine gun fire at the steps of the museum, which, you know, as the guards kind of came running out. So they did a double, they did that
right,
old stone cop maneuver and
sure,
ran back in. But so there you have a guy that kind of fits that bill. And, but, you know, in the end, Miles Connor, you know, ended up getting pretty much himself robbed of everything he had. And he's kind of lives in this kind of, you know, strange twilight with these exotic animals. And, you know, all the things that he stole over the years were stolen from him.
Well, that would come closest to fitting that movie image, even the idea of laying down suppressing machine gun fire. That isn't typical, I think, of the art heist, but that there are plenty of people who have just walked into a museum with an X-Acto knife, just cut the picture out of the frame, rolled it up, put it underneath their arm, and walked out.
That's true. Although the idea that they roll it up is a myth. It's usually not rolled, and especially an old master painting. They're quite old. They've been relined over the years. So there's an extra layer of canvas and a lot of glue in the back. So it's very difficult to roll an old painting like that.
Okay, fair enough. But still, they just sort of conceal it then under their jacket and walk out after cutting it from the frame. And that may be a much more common technique. But you mentioned organized crime or disorganized crime, sort of low-level crime figures, people who just have sort of it's almost a crime of opportunity. They see it, they try it, they once they capture it, then they try to sell it like anything else. And then the drug mule type, the person out there that's the local drug pusher. But if you had to say the most successful art thieves in history, wouldn't they have to be governments?
Oh yeah, no question.
I mean, especially, I mean, it's not hard for us to imagine the Nazis, who did a lot of art stealing.
Well, the Nazis are in a class by themselves because they emptied out all these beautiful French museums and Belgian museums and, you know, private homes. And, you know, they just boxed all this stuff and sent it back to Hitler and Goering. And, you know, it was just, you know, a disgusting, you know, thing, you know, where they were just basically, you know, putting these things on their walls. Actually, you ought to see a movie sometime called The Train with Burt Lancaster. It's a great movie about just that sort of thing and how he tries to prevent all this art from winding up in the hands of the Nazis.
But it's not just the Nazis, and I want to get back to that coming up in just a minute, but also the British, pretty well known for that. And did we get all the art back that the Nazis stole? We'll find out about that coming up in just a second. There's a few more of these untold stories of notorious art heists I want to get to along the way with Anthony Amore and Tom Mashburg, co-authors of the book Stealing Rembrandts. And again, coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, we've got Howard Bloom on. We'll be talking about the economy and very specifically what might happen with this debt ceiling. That's tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, and we'll get to open lines coming up probably next hour sometime soon. We'll give you the numbers. You can join in the conversation, and you can follow me on Twitter too, Deacon Punnett, DEACON, and then Punnett, two N's, two T's, Deacon Punnett. You can find that Twitter feed and sign up, and you get all the early look at all of the guests that are coming up on Coast to Coast. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett.